Welcome to You Don't Even Like This Band, a podcast about bands you probably don't even like.
We hope you don't know this one.
With your hosts, Adam Todd Brown, Andy Sell, and Travis Clark.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Steve Earle season of the Unpops Music Podcast, a.k.a. Transcendental Pod, a.k.a. I'll Never Get Out of This Podcast Alive. That's a good title right there.
Yeah. I'm still partial to Shut Up and Die Like a Podcaster, though.
I think we should call it I Feel Like a Podcast.
Yeah.
Or I Feel Podcast.
I Feel Podcast. I Feel All Pod.
Yeah.
We got a podcast a-coming, too.
Oh.
Ah, that's not a bad one.
We're killing it today. Let's just do this for an hour. Let's just come up with potential titles.
Here's the thing. We could do that for a solid hour.
Yeah, it would have been a good thing to do before we started recording this, but yeah, whatever. Hey, how's everyone doing?
I had foot surgery, so, you know, that's fun.
Weird.
I just wanted my foot to look younger, so I got a foot lift.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, cosmetic foot surgery.
Yeah. It's important.
It's pretty big right now.
Yeah.
How about you, Andy? How are your feet?
I don't know. You have to pay me for my, OnlyFans.
Yeah, you don't show your feet for free. I understand. No, I wouldn't on the internet with either.
Andy, are you showing your feet to people on the internet? Andy!
Wow.
Andy!
Wow.
How did that happen with your voice, Travis? That seemed a little more...
That was the foot surgery.
Oh.
You don't know this, but there are actually two vocal cords
to change my voice now, Andy. Andy, I can change my voice.
Oh, my God. Okay, now we have to do another Limp Bizkit season.
Yeah, we've entered a new realm.
Entirely dedicated to pitching our Limp Bizkit Saw movie.
So when we last left off, we were right around the point where Steve Earle had released his fourth album, The Hard Way. I think we've all listened to that album by now. There's a song with his sister on it called Promise You Anything. That song was her first time ever performing. Like, she had been playing guitar and things and like trying to write songs. So Steve Earle lets her be on this song on his fourth album. And then he approaches her after and says, hey, you did great. Now you're going on tour. Learn a bunch of songs.
Wow.
Which, you know, of course you want to take a person from performing one time in private to, you just want to throw them right in the eye of the storm there.
Yeah. And she's already married with kids at this point and has like other negative history with Steve.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a great call. Also, I love the song title, Promise You Anything, and like listen to the lyrics. Like, this song should have been a red flag to her. This should have been like a sign that, you know, this is what people with addictions do. I will promise you anything. I will say anything you want to hear. Like, yeah, this is going to go to great places.
Yeah, you want to go on tour? Let's go on tour. You want to be in the band? You're in the band. You got it.
This ends up becoming a big rift between them. They have a few different songs together, and one of them we're not really going to get into in the notes, but it happens later after Steve Earle gets out of jail and whatnot. And that song, I believe he wrote it, but if you read interviews with him, he's like, I don't agree with her standpoint on that song. And it's like, didn't you write the lyrics?
Wow.
Again, another typical addict thing. Like, I don't agree with my own words that you're using against me. That's not how I feel anymore.
I didn't do that. What are you talking about? I don't remember it.
So part of the reason she was on tour, though, was also to take care of Steve Earle, because he was a fucking mess by this point.
To be fair, I think most backup singers, that is their job, is to make sure whoever's in the band, whoever the lead singer is like, kind of keeping it together.
If you read the book, the things she did to take care of him are intense. She would braid his hair every night and then brush it out in the morning. It's like, you're not a baby doll, sir. You are a grown musician.
I'm a baby doll and I need my hair braided.
Is Steve Earle the Prince of Zamunda? What the fuck?
Very strange dynamic. The tour kicks off in Australia, which meant getting heroin was going to be tough. So to stave off withdrawals, he was prescribed an antidepressant called Buprenex. And the problem is, one, that's also very addictive. And it also has a bunch of side effects that make it so you can't take other drugs, which that's a bummer. So he's in Australia, yeah. has no drugs except an antidepressant. But don't worry, he met a whore.
Oh.
Her words, not mine.
Okay.
There's a story in this book. He's in Australia, and some woman just walks up to him on the street and says, "Are you Steve Earle?" And he says, "Yes, I'm looking for drugs." And she cheerfully says, "I'm a whore." And from that point on, Steve Earle is sorted for drugs in Australia. This woman would bring him drugs every night, and people would worry. But he was high, so...
It's like you went into the right village in Legend of Zelda 2. You know, you hit up under the right door at the right house, and there's just a, "I'm a whore" in there, and then he gets all the drugs he wants.
Yeah, it says, "I'm a whore," and you press X, and then drugs are given to you.
Yeah.
She shoots a needle into your arm from across the room.
There's a few problems, I think, with this, just from a logistics point of view. What doctor is giving Steve Earle a drug that prevents him from taking other drugs? Like, right off the bat, you're like, "Well, that might not be the right medication for you, sir."
Well, it's Michael Jackson's doctor.
It's Elvis's doctor, remember?
Yes. Yeah, Elvis. Doctor to the stars. Also, why Buprenex? Buprenex, what a name. It's a dubstep DJ.
All right, everybody. I'm Buprenex. Who's feeling better than they felt before I got here? Yeah. Don't take other drugs.
That was fun. So this is a quote from Dan Gillis, bus driver and manager to Steve Earle. His addiction was out of control at that point. "I'd go to bed at night wondering if I'd get a phone call from somebody saying they'd found him dead in his room." And no, you'd probably be the one to discover him dead in his room.
Yeah, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, think about that for a minute. Yeah, so we're in the dark part now, right?
We are in the incredibly dark part of the Steve Earle story. It's going to get darker. Don't worry.
I mean, we started pretty dark. First episode. Oh, he did heroin for the first time the summer before high school. Well, this is fun.
We started at 11 doing heroin, or 12. I don't want to, don't let me.
Yeah, come on, Travis.
Don't let me get hyperbolic on when he started heroin. And now we've got Dan Gillis basically not wanting to do his job. Yeah. Like, hope someone calls me. Yeah.
Probably going to find him dead. Whatever.
Yeah, it was so bad at this point that when shows would end, the band would just like towel off and then get immediately on the bus and go to the hotel to shower instead of, you know, showering up at the venue. Which, I'm going to be honest, if I was I've toured before, like actually toured, those showers at these venues, no thanks. I'd rather wash up at a laundromat. They are often horrifying. But it's also gross riding home full of sweat. But Steve Earle was too busy in the dressing room getting super duper high. Like, not just kind of high.
Yeah, I feel like for a while now, people have not really been into hanging around him.
He's a whole problem to be around. It's just that he's still making really good music and his shows are still good. So people are like, "What are we going to do?"
Yeah, it's truly wild how bad it's allowed to get.
So the post-show hang is more of a post-show tie-off and everyone else is just running off to the hotel.
Right. But Steve Earle was having fun.
Best time of his life.
He loved touring in Australia because, this is a quote from him, "It's an island populated by beautiful women and ugly, stupid men. All you have to do to impress girls is not hit them."
I mean, cynical, but cool.
A little bit cynical, I guess.
But aren't the Hemsworths Australian?
Yeah, they hit women.
I'm just saying, there's a lot of like, really?
Whoa.
But only with magical hammers. With magical hammers. It's the only way they do it.
Well, Paul Hogan would hit him with a boomerang.
Or a knife.
Yeah. Jesus. Okay, wow.
That's not domestic abuse. This is domestic abuse.
Oh, my God. What was Yahoo Serious's weapon of choice?
Career death.
Wow.
So he's having fun in Australia. Lots of fun. He's got a sex worker, proper term, bringing him heroin every night, very strong heroin, which actually presented a problem on the next leg of the tour, which was in England. A flight that doesn't strike me as one that would be that long, but maybe it is. I don't know if it's long enough that you would need to pack 6 syringes of heroin for that flight, but Steve Earle did that.
Well, this isn't he's not flying directly from Australia to England. There's some time in between here, right?
What do you mean? I don't know the exact itinerary. They land somewhere and he goes in the airport to smoke a cigarette. So yeah, there must have been a layover.
Okay.
So maybe it was 3 syringes of heroin for the first leg, 3 for the second, which is more reasonable.
You got a ration.
Yeah, he wasn't worried about having to bring any of that heroin through customs because he planned to use it all on the plane. But problem is, the heroin he was getting in Australia was so strong that when he was able to cop heroin in England, it was not strong enough to keep him from withdrawing from heroin. So he's that fucking high that he's putting heroin in his arms and still withdrawing from heroin at the same time.
The U.S. heroin to, you know, British heroin conversion rate is kind of it's the inverse of the pound to dollar rate. So it's like, you know, for every dollar, you know, it's 1.38 here, our heroin here, versus though just 1 heroin in the U.K.
And they weren't on the euro heroin system yet at that point.
No,
they were
still doing
they were still doing British pounds heroin. And, you know, they say in England, stiff upper lip, weaker heroin.
That is exactly what they say. I believe Winston Churchill said that.
Yeah, keep calm.
We shall defend our heroin, whatever the cost.
Yeah.
So he just kind of, I guess, had to fight through that. He was still withdrawing from heroin.
While on heroin. He was withdrawing from heroin while on heroin.
You are doing a few too many drugs when that... I mean, I'm not a professional. I'm not an addiction counselor, but I would go out on a limb and say you're doing too much heroin in that.
Adam, I'm sorry. I've been under a cloud of misinformation this whole time. I thought that was your profession, as you were an addiction specialist, and that's what we were.
That's why we're covering Steve Earle. Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm so effective at it that I think it gives people the impression.
That might be it.
Yeah. This is another quote, this time from Pat Earle, Steve's brother. Steve, as things got further and further downhill, became less and less human. It got to a point where I hadn't had a real conversation with him in years. It's a long time.
Yeah, that's so rough. I can relate. It's, yeah, wow.
I forget now the
I don't have anything funny to say.
I don't either. I'm just wondering, did we ever dive into how big the Earle clan is? Like, how many of how many kids he's a member? Like,
oh, I think there's just the 2 siblings, Stacy and Pat.
Stacy.
Yeah. And then his parents.
And don't forget the fun uncle who got him hooked on heroin.
That guy rules. Uncle Heroin.
This next album's called Uncle Heroin. It's about my summer as a 12-year-old.
So the thing about this, we keep bringing this part up. Steve Earle's a mess, but everyone agrees that the shows on these tours were fucking amazing. Like, you hear that about Nirvana, that last tour where Kurt Cobain was supposed to be in such terrible shape and so depressed. If you go listen to those shows, they're great.
It's dangerous. Like, I don't know. Nothing. I'm not saying I was a great comic by any stretch. But when I was, like, really drinking, and it was before I quit, occasionally people would say to me, like, oh, your set last night, that was the best I've ever seen you, and shit like that. And it's like, oh, I was blacked out. I don't remember any of that. So that's a bad thing for you to tell me. Don't encourage this. I mean, probably heroin probably makes you more talented than alcohol, I would imagine, at least from what I've seen.
I think drugs in general are a little better for creativity than alcohol.
I think drugs, when you're kind of in the early throes of them before it becomes just spiraling addiction, I think the allure of them is it kind of lets you go on autopilot, and the bullshit that gets in the way of you being creative isn't there anymore. You know,
you just stop caring about literally everything else. And so that's where all your focus is. Also, if you're like spinning out on the edge like that, like, you know, your thoughts are going to be dark, and therefore they're going to, like, your lyrics are going to be, they're going to seem a little more immediate.
Right, but you're more in the moment. You're not like, oh, is that a shitty idea? Oh, is that derivative? You're just in pure, like, here's, this is me. This is what's going to happen. And it just happens.
Yeah, the the fact that these shows were so good makes what happens next kind of surprising. The record label he was on, he was still on MCA at this point, and they realized they're not going to get a new record out of Steve Earle anytime soon because he's just too fucked up. So they decide to go with a live album. And let me tell you, that live album is not good. The band sounds great. Steve Earle is a mess.
Yeah, he sounds bad on it.
I kind of liked it, though. I know. I don't want to be the contrarian here, but
here we go.
That said, I liked it. I thought it was fun because it's that Steve Earle character in his voice that is kind of the Steve Earle that I came into when I first saw him as a character on The Wire. Like, he kind of has that, like, guy who's been down a dark road, even though it's kind of the beginning of the dark road-ish for him. Yeah.
The thing. He's like in The Wire, he's like, you know, he's recovering. He's like, he's got a command of himself. In this album, like, he feels out of control.
He set his GPS for the dark road.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is another quote from Dan Gillis. You know, you do that much drugs, it affects your throat. He was sick and he'd been singing a lot. He didn't really have time to recover and his immune system was down. He was a mess, and trying to record the shows, it was brutal. It was a hard thing, and that record is not very good. Yeah. And I mean, the songs are great. They're just his songs from his past four albums.
Yeah.
And
to your point, Adam, about how the band is sound, like, the band really does sound great. And for a live album, you can tell, like, they really put some time into, like, breaking out how the different instruments are, like, recorded, and it sounds great. It's interesting in that regard, at least.
He has like three, I think, live albums in the 90s, and he sounds better on the other two than he does on this. But the band is, I think, the one where the band sounds the best.
Yeah. So now we've reached the point where people just start kind of giving up on Steve Earle. Case in point, his sister Stacy finally moved her kids out of his house.
This is so beyond the point where everyone would have given up on, like, literally anyone else. He got so much further, I think.
The kids have been there this whole time, like, back from...
They sure have.
The hard way times that they've been with him? Or no, previous to that.
Yeah, I think it was around the time of Copperhead Road.
Yeah, because they were like, oh, your life's out of control. What if kids were around you?
Yeah, when she had to keep buying new spoons because he kept cooking heroin in them.
Oh, my God.
To make sure her kids weren't eating heroin, their cereal with heroin spoons.
I had that problem at one point, too, but I was just making tiny creme brulees in spoons.
I found that it's good to stir the heroin spoon in your coffee. Actually.
It does wake. Like, yeah, it's a weird high because you're sleepy and awake at the same time.
I've always been a big heroin toast crunch guy. That's my favorite.
Heroin nut Cheerios is the way to go.
Heroin nut Cheerios. They're good for your heart, weirdly enough.
They're heart healthy.
Rice heroin. Snap, crackle, nod off.
And yeah, there's also this really weird rift that we sort of mentioned earlier where Stacy comes home from this tour and she's like, well, now I want to be a musician, obviously. And Steve Earle sort of takes offense to that, and I don't know what he thought was gonna happen.
You removed her from her life and took her to another country with you to perform music professionally. There was no other way this was going to go.
Yeah, she's not gonna come back and be like, well, office job time.
Yeah,
now she wants to be a performer.
Yeah, and she's good on that song, at least, on that record.
She sounds like Steve Earle's sister. She has a very unique voice. Like, if I heard her out of context, I'd be like, that sounds like Steve Earle. And the thing is, he claims that she came back and went directly to his band and was like, look, Steve is done, clearly. Maybe we should just, you know, get together and write some songs and tour. And that's shitty if it's true, but in her defense, he was done.
he was done. Like, he was, the band didn't like being around him anymore.
Yeah. And like, that tour ends up being one of the last things he does for years, because it's 1991. He goes back to Los Angeles, starts writing the songs that would eventually appear on the I Feel All Right album. Please note that album was not released until 1996, and some shit happens in between.
Sometimes you just need to go discover yourself for 5 years to really then come back to the songs and make them work.
But it's, I think in a weird way, you can't put out I Feel All Right where he's at this point in his life, you know? You can't.
Well, he hadn't written that song yet.
Oh, okay.
The songs he wrote at this point are some of the darkest songs he's ever written. Hurting Me, Hurting You, The Unrepentant, and most importantly, CCKMP. Glad you asked, listeners.
I want to make some guesses. Can I make some guesses?
As to what CCKMP means?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. We got Charlie Chaplin's Kafka-esque Mario Party.
I think that was the original working definition.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I got one more. I got one more, which is
I got one more list of 20 possibilities.
No, I'm good. Chevy Chase, Kiss My Penis. Is that one?
That's what it's gonna mean from now on.
No, I think it stands for Captain Crunch Knows Marxist Propaganda.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, yeah.
What it really means, listeners, is Cocaine Cannot Kill My Pain.
Oh, that's that's a little darker.
I was close.
It's a very, very dark song. And I imagine at this point when it was written, I bet watching him write it was very dark, too. I doubt anyone was in the room, but there's a lot of drug songs in the world, and most of them don't sound like this. This isn't happy party drug time. It's not even like the Velvet Underground singing about heroin, which was still dark, but they were like, it's cool, man. Steve Earle's just like, I'm in trouble.
And before I got to like hear a lot of these songs, like just the titles, you're like, that's messed up. Though Hurting Me, Hurting You, I just wanted to go, sweet heroin.
Yeah, for sure. These are all, I mean, I like all three of these songs.
They're three great songs, three of the darkest songs he ever wrote. They also end up being the last three songs he wrote for nearly 4 years. Because at this point, I cannot wrap my head around this. At this point in history, 1991, he's spending $200 on heroin and up to $400 on cocaine per day.
That's, Jesus. Travis, what's that with inflation?
With inflation, that's fucking way too much.
That's so much.
That's a lot of fucking money a day.
And the thing is, the woman he's with at this point, again, A&R person who discovered Guns N' Roses. So they had money. Like, they were making up to $1 million a year at this point, even though his records weren't like flying off the shelves. So he could afford it sort of for a while, but eventually, no. That's so much money.
$600 a day.
That's $219,000 a year.
Jesus. All on heroin.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a hell of a per diem.
That's why, because this is one of those things when you quit smoking cigarettes, I want to specify, one of the incentives that you know, they use in these like apps and quitting programs and stuff is to like calculate how much a year you spend on cigarettes. And that's how much you'll save if you quit per year. For me, it was like $2,000, I think, or something around there a year. This is $219,000.
Yeah. You got an executive level position of free money now from not doing heroin and cocaine every day.
That's a Lovecraftian exponentially different, like, that's a gulf. I don't know how to that's like jumping from millionaire to billionaire. I don't know how to calculate this.
Imagine being his drug dealer. Like, at some point you're just gonna be like, do you want me to move in?
I mean, that's an entire industry that's gonna collapse when he quits.
Yeah, he's really a job creator at this point.
Yeah, he's fucking, he's gonna kill that industry if he quits heroin and cocaine. The Steve Earle Industrial Speedball Complex.
Look, man, you can't. If he goes away, the whole dark economy collapses.
Wow.
So naturally, the obvious next progression here. Mm-hmm. This is the point in history where Steve Earle starts smoking crack.
I mean, just from a business decision, smart, you know?
That's cheaper. That's cheaper. It's more fiscally responsible, you know? Definitely.
I feel like his business manager was like, listen, Steve, you can't keep living like this. Have you thought about crack? It's just a lot more affordable.
We know you're not going to quit. Just downgrade.
I know you don't like doing jingles, but hear me out. There's this new thing, and they want you, Steve.
Steve, I mean, they made this not specifically for you, but they might as well have. This is for you. You, of everybody I've met, you, sir, are a crack man.
Wow.
The way he starts smoking crack is a very entertaining story. Dan Gillis lines him up a tour during this incredibly dark point in his life.
Wait, the bus driver?
Yeah, well, he's also his manager.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And they set off in a Cadillac to go on this tour. And at one point, they have a show in New Jersey.
Oh, man. Was Springsteen there?
Probably. And after this show, Dan Gillis drops Steve Earle off in Manhattan to go look for drugs. And what I love about this story, at least as it's presented in the book, have either of you heard that speech where Joe Biden tells a story about Corn Pop?
Yeah. I watched the video, yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of how this reads in the book. We've been like not really quoting this book and kind of glossing over things, but this is directly from the book Hardcore Troubadour, discussing when Steve Earle started smoking crack. Steve was looking for Popeye, a cocaine addict, prematurely aged by junk. His world-weary face as easily 56 as 26. Popeye was on the slow side, but he was useful to an out-of-towner because he always had a handle on the heroin spots that move like quicksilver ahead of the law. Steve wanted to buy crack off the street. Popeye suggested they could buy cocaine and cook it. Steve confessed he didn't know how. I don't either, Popeye said, but I can take you to someone who does. Joe Biden wrote that.
Don't go to a second location with Popeye.
No, listen, I'm serious here. Okay, there's Popeye, okay? There's a Popeye guy. And he knew how to cook. You know, I'm really being serious here. He knew how to cook the cocaine.
So that story ends with Steve Earle sitting at a table in an abandoned building in Manhattan in front of a woman who is described as a Jamaican woman with a mustache, who is showing him how to cook crack. And whenever it starts crackling, she goes, "Listen to the speech."
This is just so well written that I can't wait to read this book now.
Yeah, I meant to send you both the book and then I just fucking forgot. I'll do it today. Yeah, the book is amazing. I cannot stress enough how much we're skipping over. We skipped a whole family Christmas that was meant to get Steve Earle off drugs, but ends with someone like buying him crack for Christmas.
Oh, I'm sorry. We skipped a very special Steve Earle Christmas.
There's so much in this book.
Sorry, a very Steve Earle Christmas special?
How is that not one of his songs, I Got You Crack for Christmas? Like, how is that not on any of these albums?
That was in the original lyrics to Valentine's Day, but then he changed it.
So just real quick, I have very, very limited experience with crack.
I have smoked crack before. Ask away.
It's literally named crack because it cracks while you're cooking. It's like Rice Krispies, but cocaine?
And when you smoke it, it also makes a crackling noise.
I'm sorry, you said you've done this?
Yes, twice.
Did you ever say listen to the speech while you did it?
I did not.
So well, then you have to do it again because you were doing it wrong.
Listen, we're all talking about getting together and maybe doing some shows together. I think we're all going to have to smoke crack together and so we can at least say listen to the speech while we do it.
I'm going to say it without the accent because I would feel really weird saying it with
the accent. I feel I didn't really do an accent so much as an intention and a placement.
I'm just going to do an Irish accent and it'll sound close enough.
Listen to the speech, me laddies. Someone's got me.
I've never done crack, but I've been present while crack was being smoked.
It's a very distinctive smell once you smell it. It smells like burning plastic.
That's what I've heard. It smells like someone said like a water bottle being burned.
Yeah.
I understand why people get hopelessly addicted to crack. It's not the kind of thing you would want to smoke 2 days in a row. Because if you do it 2 days in a row, you're going to do it like 255 days in a row.
It smells like burning plastic. Like if it smells like burning plastic, it has to make you feel good if you want to do it again. Because that smell right there, I'm already out.
So now Steve Earle's doing crack. That's a big step up when it comes to drugs. But also not really. If you're already doing speedballs, that's bad times there.
Yeah, I feel like it's a pretty short step from speedballs to crack. I know. I mean, it's. I feel like sometimes it's even reversed maybe.
Can you kick heroin with crack?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, maybe that's what he was doing. Like heroin replacement therapy.
Guys, I no longer drink sugary sodas. I've just started drinking Jack Daniels. I'm fine. Everything's great.
You just smoke a little crack once every hour and then step it down every 2 hours, every 3 hours, till you're not smoking crack anymore.
Ask your drug dealer if crack is right for you.
So from the point where he starts smoking crack, if you can believe this, very, very fast trip downhill from there.
Yeah.
Things really start going off the rails. For the first time ever in his career, he starts canceling shows because he's too sick and or fucked up to perform. First time it happens is in England, but to his credit, he did make some of those shows. There were other tours where he just did not show up at all. Case in point, he was booked on the Winnipeg Folk Festival, which again, he still gets so many opportunities, even though he's almost a vagrant at this point. And he's booked on the Winnipeg Folk Festival. Dan Gillis drives to Toronto to meet Steve at the airport. Steve never showed up. And this is a quote. At that point, we canceled the Winnipeg Folk Festival and it was over. It's Dan Gillis. Steve Earle said, after that, I gave up. From that point on, I was never the same again. Yeesh.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he is so strung out on drugs by 1991 that he literally will not leave his neighborhood, especially not to get on a plane because he knows he's flying away from his source of drugs. And somehow things just keep getting worse from there.
Yeah, this is usually the point where there's not a lot of room for things getting better.
I think it's odd
when you go from functioning to, well, now he can't even do the thing that he was doing when he was, you know.
I'm aware that crack is not good for you. I'm very aware of that. But it's like when you have somebody who was basically a functional drug addict on an enormous amount of heroin and cocaine, and then crack starts, and it's like, I can't do shit now. That's so telling.
Yeah. Well, I also think that a lot of that, though, kind of revolves around like the drug war machinery and, you know, the legal apparatus around all these, you know, the criminalization of drugs, where it's like, I mean, that in a lot of ways that just exacerbates it. And I think it's even harder on crack because of, you know, the racial and economic implications of crack use than it is on heroin and cocaine. Like, it's probably, I would imagine, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about.
I think he's so... I think he's so incredibly fucked up now that, like, he can't do anything. Whereas before, he could do $600 a day worth of other drugs and still go to a folk festival.
Yeah, and now he can't. Now he can't even go to a folk festival.
At this point, he's spending all of his money on drugs. Not really eating. He starts pawning guitars.
Oh, that's a bad one.
Yeah, he gets to a point where he literally does not own a guitar anymore. Steve Earle does not own a guitar.
Well, yeah, it's Charlie Parker, too.
And there's stories about him all over L.A. There's one where this MCA marketing guy claims he walked in the bathroom and found Steve Earle shooting heroin at an MCA party. Steve Earle's defense is, I don't remember that, but why would I go to an MCA party?
Jesus Christ.
Or it's like, I'm at this MCA party. Shit, I got to do something to maintain.
Yeah.
When he does get work, like when he was tasked with composing the soundtrack for a movie about a group of Asian kids who start a country band, he never manages to get it done. He was hired to produce a band called The Immigrants, which was one half of the band Gene Loves Jezebel, if anyone remembers them.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, they needed to make another band. Good for them.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely want to split that off into two entities.
Hey.
He lost that job after he showed up at a dinner with the band and label executives in L.A. and upon sitting down, immediately passed out face first onto the table.
Amazing.
How do we not have a movie about Steve Earle?
I know.
At this point. Like, yeah. That scene alone.
It could be a franchise.
Yeah, it could be the Hangover meets Crazy Heart, you know, just kind of put those two together.
So the final nail in the coffin of his professional career, at least for a while, came with a New Year's Eve show that he'd set up in New York at the end of 1991.
Oh my God, all of this is in 91?
Yeah, we haven't even hit 1992
oh
yet.
God.
It's going to be a long road.
Big year, big year.
Steve Earle arranges this show in New York with some guy that he buys drugs from. And this guy calls Dan Gillis and is like, Steve's doing a show on New Year's Eve and you have to come do sound. And Dan Gillis is like, what? I haven't heard anything about this. But because he is a loyal servant, he drives to Manhattan on New Year's Eve to do sound for this show. Steve Earle shows up at 2 a.m. when
wow,
pretty much everyone has already gone home.
Yeah, that's New Year's Day now.
Yeah, that is the next year. Now it's 1992. And that's the last time Dan Gillis sees him for a couple years. This kicks off a period in Steve Earle history known as the Vacation in the Ghetto.
So 1991 was the year punk and Steve Earle broke.
Yes.
Okay.
They just broke in different ways.
Yeah, in very different ways.
His wife at the time left him after he spent the early part of April 1992 living on the streets. So he has a home, but he's just so fucked up, he's not there. He's sleeping on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, there's more crack probably not at home.
And because he was becoming so familiar with police in L.A., he decided to pack up and move back to Nashville. And this is why they call it the Vacation in the Ghetto. He goes there and he spends a couple years splitting his time between crack houses in South Nashville and this seedy dive motel in Nashville called the Travelers Motel, and mostly just cooking crack and hanging out with fellow crackheads. And he does this for years, like 2 or 3 years.
So he took an off year. He took a me year from his entertainment career in LA. I get it. I think it's funny that most people leave LA because they can't get popular enough. You know, nobody knows who they are, and Steve's leaving because everybody knows who he is.
Yeah, it's his eat, pray, love moment. It's just don't eat, don't pray, smoke.
Yeah, I just need to go on a crack sabbatical for a couple of years, and then I can come back.
This is the moment when one of the most notorious incidents of Steve Earle's life happens.
This is still so fucking insane to me.
Yeah, despite being an actual, sometimes homeless junkie, Steve Earle was still a highly respected musician. So much so that his lawyer, David Simone, managed to get him competing contract offers from Mercury and Virgin Records.
All right. Imagine you are at a crack house in 1992 in South Nashville, and you meet an unhoused heroin crack addict, and he's like, "Yeah, man, my manager's got me competing deals with Virgin Records and Mercury." You'd be like, no, this is, I get it. I've heard unhoused people with addiction problems talk before and claim crazy, wild things. You would not believe this, but you would be wrong to not believe it.
But also, too, we're talking about a time when, like, cell phones aren't really a thing that everybody has. Like, how are you even getting in touch with Steve Earle during this time?
That's the problem. People can't most of the time. He just goes missing on the streets.
They send a crow.
Send a raven for Earl.
Steve Earle talks to the crows.
So his lawyer secures these two deals, these competing offers. All Steve Earle has to do is fly to New York to meet with them both and decide which deal he wanted to take. He didn't have to impress anyone. He didn't have to have new songs. He just had to show up. And the night before the first meeting, he does not show up at the hotel. So the next morning, David Simone wakes up to find that Steve Earle was just missing. He was seen at the airport in Nashville, but never managed to get on the plane. A few hours later, he calls David Simone and said that he had fallen ill, and even worse, he lost his plane ticket. Oh, no.
Oh, man, that can happen.
Yeah, what a unfortunate turn of events.
I lost my plane ticket, but I found this crack.
So David Simone pushes all the meetings back a day, and lines up another flight for Steve. Steve Earle calls from the airport shortly before the second flight and assures David Simone that he's on his way. That phone call was the last time David Simone heard from Steve Earle for 3 years. As it turns out, he sold that second plane ticket at the gate for $100, way different time, pre-9/11, and took off to a crack house. This is a quote from David Simone. He never turned up, and obviously, we never did the deal. And it was devastating, not because of the deal, but emotionally for me, because this guy who was so special was just killing himself. That's the story that kicks off the book. Like, it's not even in the first chapter. That's just how the book opens.
Wow.
There's a part of me that does love the idea of calling anyone and being like, yep, I'm on my way, and then never talking to them again for 3 years.
Like, did you get murdered? What happened?
That's the Earlish goodbye.
The Earlish goodbye.
Yeah, I'll be on that plane, man. I'm coming right out.
Oh, yeah, I gave him the Earlish goodbye. What is that? That's where I said I'm on my way, but then don't talk to them for 3 years. It's really, it's a power move.
Sorry, man, plane crashed. We all died.
I'm a ghost. I'm calling you as a ghost.
Are you high right now? No, I'm a ghost, man.
No, I'm a ghost. Ghosts can't get high. Wish I could. I met this ghost Jamaican woman. She made me some ghost crack. It's amazing.
Listen to the speech. So this begins a period of time where Steve Earle's main pursuit is just getting in trouble with the law. Man, is this point in history a shockingly representative example of white privilege.
Oh, yeah.
Well, not just that. He's also
a celebrity, you know, to a degree.
Yeah, that helps a bit too, right?
Yeah. Case in point, there's one incident in Tennessee where he gets pulled over for a broken taillight while he's driving high and on a suspended license. He assumes he's going to jail, but instead the police just asked if he was going home. And when he said he was, they just let him go home. So he's like, sweet. Then they showed up at his house a few hours later and took him into custody on suspicion of drug possession.
You fellas want to hear a song real quick?
That might have helped.
Yeah. Y'all got a guitar because I pawned all mine.
This one's about how William S. Burroughs is an asshole.
So when they finally search his house, he says they found camping equipment, but it was the things you need to cook crack, like butane.
I use that stove for camping.
I'm homeless.
That's my camping needle.
My camping needle.
I put my s'mores on that.
They also find traces of cocaine and, most interestingly, a police department shotgun.
Oh, that's where that went.
Oh, are you not supposed to have those? Because I have one.
Was it given to you by a friend in the police department?
No.
Okay. This one was.
I stole it off a cop.
I killed a cop. Took it from his dog. So yeah, a friend in the police department had given him a police issue shotgun as a gift. So that friend got fired after this happened.
What cop is like, you know who needs a shotgun? That guy I'm always pulling over for drug charges.
Why don't you get a better addiction, son? Take this gun and shoot it. It's just like smoking crack.
You know what? This is probably irresponsible on me, but I'm just going to give you a department-issued shotgun. You know, that way it's a little more safe.
There is a very good chance that you're going to use this gun against me at some point, but here you go.
care to raise the stakes, Mr. Earle? I'm going to give you this shotgun.
So there's another incident. At one point, Stacy and her husband check into a hotel for a night just to get away from Steve. He had basically showed up in Nashville and just moved in with them. And again, his argument is, well, I never spent the night. I just showed up all the time and asked for money. So I wasn't really living there. And it's like, that's worse.
Yeah.
Gosh. Oh, Stacy.
They called to check on him from this hotel. They told him they just went to a movie. So they call and they're like, hey, the movie's almost done. How's it going? And he tells them not to come home because he had a gun. Turns out he went to visit one of his ex-wives, only to find that she had a new fiance. And this kicks off a series of events where he steals her dad's gun threatens to kill himself and ends up locked in Stacy's house in a standoff with a fucking SWAT team.
Okay, was her dad's gun with her, or did he go to her dad's house to take the gun? Because that would be, that's commitment right there.
It has to be that. It has to be, this girl broke my heart. I'm going to go talk to her dad. He's not helping. I'm going to take his gun and I'm going to go and really solve this.
I'm going to go talk to her dad. He's a cop. He'll give me a gun. If history has proven anything, it's that a cop's going to give me a gun if I ask. I'm Steve Earle.
There are two things I know about cops. They let you go and they give you guns.
Yeah. To protect and to serve you guns. That is their point.
If you want a gun, you find yourself a cop. My favorite part, too, is that he told his sister, he's like, don't come home. I've got a gun. Not don't come home. The SWAT team is outside.
Well, what happened, like, they're the ones who call the police, and they call the police because they're worried that he's got a gun and he's going to kill himself. And the police pick them up a little ways away from the house, and they're like, all right, we're all just going to drive up here and we're just going to talk to him. And then the police end up locking Stacy Earle and her husband in back of the car. They cannot get out. And then they call a SWAT team in. And they're in the back of the car like, Steve Earle's going to die. You're going to kill my brother. And their house was the kind where you can get locked in if you lose the key. I don't know if you've ever lived in a place like that. Mm-hmm. But
no.
It's one where the door locks from both sides and you have to have a key. He lost the key. So the police come up to the door and they're like, open the door. And he's like, I can't open the door. I lost the key. Will you please come around back? And they're like, no, open the door.
Wow. Okay. Well, yep. Cops were always cops.
So his sister and her husband are locked in the back of the car screaming that they have a key so the police can just go in. But somehow the police manage to get in. They talk for a few minutes and then Steve Earle just leaves and goes walking down the street. And the police come over and go, all right, he's out of the house. That's what you wanted, right? And they're like, no, he's going to go die. Like,
oh my God.
There are illegal guns and drugs in the house. Why are you just letting him go? And the cop looks at Stacy Earle and says, those guns and drugs are in your house. You have 5 minutes to get rid of them or we're arresting you.
Wow. The police, man. Don't you love the police? They always make things better. They always fix things.
They do. They help. They help.
Yeah, they never escalate. They always solve problems. This, to me, is a problem solved. You know, how are you going to defund that? How are you going to defund that? You know, abolish reasonable outcomes? Come on, get out of here.
You can't do police work like that for free. You need some taxpayer dollars. So by August 1993, he'd been arrested two more times, both for drug possession. He's still getting work, though, like how he was tasked with recording a song with Joe Walsh for the Beverly Hillbillies soundtrack. Joe Walsh, who is notoriously sober by this point. And you send Steve Earle to go record with him? That doesn't sound like a good idea.
The Beverly Hillbillies soundtrack? I forgot they made that.
So the Beverly Hillbillies soundtrack is one of those like 90s concept soundtracks. You know, I mean, it's not Judgment Night level, but it's a bunch of old country standards and hits being covered by 90s country artists.
And Joe Walsh.
And Joe Walsh, yeah. And Jim Varney does Hot Rod Lincoln on it.
So during this trip to L.A. to record with Joe Walsh, Steve Earle did the following things. Got a switchblade pulled on him and his manager while buying crack.
Check.
Overdosed on said crack.
Check.
What else are you going to do with it, you know?
Successfully recorded a version of Honey Don't with Joe Walsh.
Here, got this that is, this, yeah. This is the one that stands out.
Yeah. That's also the one that's like, we got to get this one out of the way to do the other things.
He had an argument with the producer of the song and vanished for 3 days.
Yeah, check. That's not a surprise.
Called his manager to tell him that he went to Joshua Tree and then disappeared again when the manager said he was coming to get him.
Oh, that's classic Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Calls 3 hours later to say he'd wrecked the car his manager rented, fled on foot, leaving drugs and drug paraphernalia in the car, and was no longer sure where the car even was. His manager eventually finds him laying in the fetal position on a sidewalk somewhere in Los Angeles.
Okay, and he wrapped it up. He wrapped it up in true Steve Earle fashion.
Yeah.
The only one out. I mean, this. All of these things, though, are the price that you have to pay if you want a Steve Earle, Joe Walsh cover of a Carl Perkins song. For a Penelope Spheeris 90s adaptation of a popular television show.
You can hear all of this on the record. You know, that's what's important, is that it's all of this that really kind of
leaks. It's all in the song. He really left it all in the studio with this one.
So to get around this unfortunate incident where Steve Earle lost a car somewhere in Los Angeles, he and his manager go back to a restaurant where they knew people had seen them and just start ranting and raving about how someone stole their car. And that works. Which, what are you going to do? Like, if you're the rental place, you're not going to be able to prove they didn't have the car stolen.
Until a book comes out that says that's not what happened.
Speaking of cars, in 1994, there was an incident where he was involved in a multi-car pileup on the highway while driving to a court date, split his forehead open, and was subsequently such an asshole in the emergency room that when Stacey Earle shows up to get him, they're like, take him now. Get him the fuck out of here. He's still wearing just his hospital gown when he leaves, still makes Stacey Earle drive him to South Nashville to buy crack. So he's standing on a street in South Nashville with a bandaged, bleeding forehead in a hospital gown, still buying crack.
I mean, that's the opening scene of the Steve Earle movie right there.
You would think, yeah. This movie has to happen.
Right? Yeah.
So another time, a drug mule almost died in Stacey Earle's home after he had trouble passing a balloon of heroin that he'd swallowed on Steve's behalf.
Again, Stacey needs some boundaries. I think, yes. Here, this is.
Listen, Steve is definitely, he has a problem, but Stacy seems to be. If you're taking somebody who missed a court date because of a multi-car pileup that split his head open, you don't pull over to pick up some crack on the way home like it's Burger King. Like you're like, no,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. Can we get Burger King? You've got Burger King. We've got burgers at home. You've got crack at home, Steve.
The thing I think was probably driving a lot of this is the concern that if you don't take him to get crack, he's just going to leave and go get it.
And it's going to be a way more dangerous scenario. And this is the way in which like the criminalizing and the drug war like causes rifts in families. And it's really fucked up.
There's a story in Scott Weiland's autobiography about a time where his wife was driving him somewhere and he was like, oh, pull over here. I have to stop quick. And she's like, I know that's where you get heroin. I'm not going to pull over. Scott Weiland jumped out of a fucking moving car to go get heroin. So like, would Steve Earle have done that if she said no? Probably.
Yeah. Man, Scott Weiland was like the grunge Steve Earle.
Oh yeah, very much so. Especially if you look at like the stuff that happened around their third album where they're trying to tour and Scott Weiland's getting arrested in housing projects in New York City looking for heroin.
Is that the one where they had to make music videos with like everybody but him because he was in prison?
I think that was the...
Oh, that's four. That's number four.
Yeah, the first video for number four, which is a really great song called Down. I actually just watched the video yesterday, coincidentally enough. And yeah, it's all them performing on video screens and then the camera.
Because he's not there. Yeah. I'm going to guess somebody somewhere has a Steve Earle, Scott Weiland meetup story that just links these two worlds together.
It's kind of like how Duff McKagan sat next to Cobain on a flight, like his flight from LA to Seattle.
Yeah. And then killed him in Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's, again, Guns N' Roses is who you go to if you want someone murdered.
They have guns in their name. They have guns in their name. Roses for the funeral. It's all there. It's all code.
So, yeah, it's just constant chaos with Steve Earle at this point in history. Just nonstop arrests and harrowing stories of securing drugs. And around this time, he had to have all of his teeth pulled and replaced with implants. Because the sugar content in the drugs he was taking had rotted all of his teeth.
It feels like having them pulled and replaced is a bit more effort than Steve would put in. I feel like the pulled part would happen.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to, like, no matter how strung out you are on drugs, you want to have teeth.
So if we see Steve Earle now, none of those are his actual
immaculate teeth surrounded by total rot. Steve Earle, just glowing white teeth and scraggly gray hair.
I love him.
This is a quote from Steve Earle. I reached a point where I thought I was going to die. I thought I was supposed to die, and I just couldn't figure out what was taking so long. That's pretty dark.
Yeah, that's around the bottom. That's where you get, yeah.
And somehow it's about to get darker, because this is the point in the book where Stacey Earle confesses that around this time, she was just kind of hoping Steve Earle would die so he could be put out of his misery. This is a quote. I prayed for him to die. Of course, it didn't happen, and I've had to carry that guilt with me all the time. I thought about putting a pillow on his face. I wanted for him to stop hurting. That seems like an appropriately bleak place to end this episode.
Wow. Yeah, that's... That's where, I mean, that's the thing. This is what it does. This is a pretty common thing in the families of people with this kind of addiction, is that you just, like, you don't know what to do to help them. You feel like everything you do is wrong and making it worse. But also, they're not the person you know and love anymore. So it almost comes to a point where, like, they've already died to you in a lot of ways. And them being around is like a ghost haunting you. And it's, I don't know if there's, you know, there's things on par with it, but I don't know if there's any worse feeling in the world. Like, so yeah, great. The end. Happy times.
Yeah, happy times.
Not ending so much on a cliffhanger as a cliff pusher. Just
yeah, and again, I encourage people to read this book. We skipped over a lot in those 4 years. A lot of dark. But
it sounds like Steve did as well. Seems like he skipped over a lot of things in 4 years.
But if you can believe it, things do turn around on the next episode.
What?
This is a surprisingly quick turnaround and a surprisingly happy ending to all of this. Like, if you heard this about anyone else, you would assume, well, okay, well, next episode is the episode where they die, right? Nope.
Yeah, and that's why I'm comfortable laughing about it most of the time, because it's like, if this didn't end the way it does, I'd feel pretty awful.
Yeah, then it would just be terribly depressing. Like, Steve Earle, like, this story ends up being kind of inspiring more than anything else. The early part shouldn't inspire you, like, to do a bunch of heroin. But after that, yeah.
Also, don't conflate his heroin addiction with reading Marx. Like, you should definitely still read Marx and, like, you know, kind of embrace these ideas. They don't all mean you're going to start smoking crack.
But what about the chapter where Marx says to start doing heroin?
Oh, just, like, it's like Catholicism. You just pick and choose, you know?
No.
You can't take it all because it's so contradictory. It's like, because then, you know.
Andy, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, each according to their means, according to their addiction, right? Yeah. Isn't that the Marxist belief?
So that's our episode. Do we have anything to plug before we get out of here? I don't. If you're listening to this, you're doing everything I need you to do. Travis, you got anything?
I just want to plug that...
I want Andy's soul.
Andy! What do you got to plug?
let me try to recalibrate here. Listen to Look Good for the Boys. It's it is a horror gossip podcast that I do with my friend Philip, and we're having a lot of fun right now. We are currently doing a month of Friday the 13th with a segment called Hot or Not Alive, where we're going through the entire Friday the 13th franchise and rating all of Jason's victims according to hotness. And
where's Kevin Bacon on that list?
Oh, you'll have to listen to find out.
All right.
That says, I haven't recorded it yet. I don't know.
No, I know where Kevin Bacon falls, but I feel like it's going to be a
unpopular opinion.
Whoa. Copyright infringement.
Yeah,
buddy.
Come on. Trademarked. So that's our episode. Let's get out of here. Travis, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Andy, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.